welcome to another episode of the Brown and Black Podcast. My name is Jack Rico.
And I'm Mike Sargent.
And every week we take a look at race and pop culture through a brown and black lens. Well, Mike, I feel that this is a special episode is because what was the last time we had a Pulitzer Prize winner on our show?
I think this is the very first time we've had one.
It's crazy.
It is. We have Michael Abels, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Music this year. And not only is that an amazing feat for a composer of color, but the piece that he did, it's an opera called Omar that he co-wrote with Rihanna Giddens. Tell the audience a little bit about how unique that is, Jack.
It's super unique. It's an opera about a Muslim American slave, and it's the only known memoir written by a slave in America in Arabic. So talk about cultural specificity. And what he was able to do, I mean, this guy's talents, his skills, his imagination, to be able to translate life experiences into sonic rhythms on screen, on television, and as a musician, you know, this is the bridge, Mike, that a lot of people, even scientists, don't even understand, that spirituality of the self and how music connects that emotion, those bridges, those experiences. And we see a lot of that within this movie, Chevalier.
What Michael Abels did with this film is, in the film, it's about a composer, Joseph Bologna, who was a person of color in a time in France in the 18th century that, let's just say, not unlike today, it's very hard to go very far. He was the only one of his kind. He's got a great story, which I won't give away here. I'll just let you hear a taste of the trailer.
Welcome to Paris, Joseph.
Monsieur, I fear this will not be a kind place to such a boy.
The boy has talent, but one in particular that is exceptional.
Very well.
I realized the more I excelled, the less I was alone.
Were you always so competitive?
The show-off who spoiled Mozart's concert.
May I play with you, monsieur?
Well, I hope this won't be embarrassing for you. Who the hell is that?
You are quite a remarkable man, Joseph.
I, Marie Antoinette, Queen of France, hereby anoint you Chevalier.
In any other country, a man of your color would not be wearing such fine clothes.
Now, in the film, we see how Chevalier, and that's a title that he earned, how he played and what made him so amazing, what made him a rival of Mozart at the time, even though most of the people listening have probably never even heard of Joseph Bologna. You don't hear his name mentioned along with all the other greats. In the film, everything that he had to perform on screen, Michael Abels wrote for Kelvin J. Harrison, who plays Joseph Bologna in the film.
And before we go to the interview with Michael Abels, you know, Mike, I had to ask him a few questions about what's happening today, because to get his perspective of how he feels about AI, for example, will classical music be forever transformed by the rise of AI? We asked Harvey Mason Jr., the CEO of the Grammys, this question in the previous episode, but how is AI specifically going to transform classical music? Will it enhance it? Will it transform it? What about diversity? Chevalier is really about a black mixed race man in the 1800s in a white dominated industry. And it feels like nothing much has changed in the century.
So if you are someone who appreciates classical music, if you're someone who appreciates music in general, and you've heard, let's just say you don't know much about classical music, and you've heard of Mozart, you've heard of Chopin, you've heard of Beethoven, but you've never heard of Joseph Bologna, A, you should see Chevalier, and B, take a listen to this interview.
Thank you.
We are here with Pulitzer Prize winning Emmy and Grammy nominated composer Michael Abels. Michael Abels, welcome to Brown and Black.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. So I have to ask you a question because, you know, we're interviewing you about the work you did on a film called Chevalier, but I want to know a little bit about you. When did you first know that music was what you wanted to do with your life? And how did that happen for you?
Well, I don't know if I knew I wanted to make it a profession, but I knew that I just was all about music from the earliest age. I remember seeing Sound of Music.
Let's start at the very beginning.
You know, one word for every note by making it up like this. And I must have sung that as like when I was in preschool, like every single day for 2 years. It just always was singing and moving to music, and started taking piano lessons at age 4 because I wanted to just make music. And it always seemed like it was always a big part of my life. So it seemed like a natural right from the start.
When you came out of school studying for music, you wanted to be a film composer. And this is in the 80s. What happened? We all know you can still count on two hands the amount of Black film composers or film composers of color out there. But what was that like for you? And what did you come up against trying to do that?
Yeah, when I was in school, I was doing music for TV commercials and radio commercials. And I was interested in writing music for every genre and medium. Didn't matter. Mm. Wanted to write songs, wanted to write films, wanted to do it all. But I could never convince anyone that I could score their film. Even though I was living in LA, my ability to break into the industry was absolutely a zero. And I didn't know why that was. I thought I was just not really good at convincing people or meeting the right people or whatever. So that's what that was like.
Let's fast forward now to the film Chevalier. I'm sure that the premise of the pitch was one that you immediately wanted to do and wanted to be a part of. How important for you and how significant was this story for you to be a part of this story at this time?
150%. I remember first hearing about Joseph Boulogne when I was in my late 20s. So I was already, I'd already had gone to school, had a degree in music, had never heard his name or heard any of his music. And I was instantly inspired and I wanted to know more. And I felt a natural connection to him. And I wondered about his life and I didn't know, there didn't seem to be much information about him.
Intentionally.
I mean, yeah. Which I did not know at the time. But nonetheless, when I heard that there was a film about his life that was going to be made, I had to be a part of it. And I was really honored to be able to help tell his story. And as a result, I learned so much more about him than I'd ever known. And fortunately, finally, he's beginning to get his due and his music is getting played. And now there's a film out of which everybody can find out about him. And in the future, young people will have a film to learn about his life. And there's nothing like that to be able to connect yourself to history. So I'm just really honored to have been involved in it.
After working on this film, Michael, who was Chevalier to you? Who was Joseph Boulogne to you? And why should people care about him after all of this time?
Well, he is one of the first Black composers in what we call classical music. He was mixed race, and which is just like me. And he was kind of a rock star in the late 1700s in France. And he was not only a composer of string quartets and symphonies concertante and operas, but he was a fencing champion. He would go around Europe doing fencing competitions for cash and winning, by the way. He was in the film, we see that he's in the running for the head of the Paris Opera. So opera was basically the movies before there was the movies. And he, you know, it's got it's got your music, it's got your lights, your no camera, but it's got your action and your singing all together. That was the entertainment. And Paris was one of the most leading artistic centers of Western thought. And Joseph Bologna was right there making music. He had an orchestra. He was a rock star. And when I think about what he had to go through in his life and dealing with the challenges of society as he experienced them, which you see in the film.
You don't belong here.
You're a party trick. You're a pet playing the violin. That is all.
I'm just in awe of him. And I feel like he has a legacy that it's up to me and people like me to uphold. And I just hope that I'm helping do him justice.
From what I understand, Chris Bowers composed the score, but you had to write the music for the on-camera performances. Tell me a little bit about what that was like for you and what experience you had that you were able to draw upon to make that happen.
So the on-camera music means the music that is done first before the film is shot. Every film has music, sometimes hours of music. A lot of that is done after the film is shot, and that's called the score. But the music that's on camera, especially when it's a film about a composer, is also crucial. It just happens at a different stage. So before the film was shot, I spent a long time talking with the director, Stephen Williams, about what each scene, what the audience needed to feel in each scene and what Joseph's motivations were. And it was important to first begin with his own music, since that's why we're here, about this composer, and to make sure his music was played in a way that's authentic, but also believable for what the character's experiencing. And then there's music of other composers of the time that we hear, and that music needed to work for those scenes. And so all those things were my responsibility. But then there's some music that Joseph plays on camera that is improvised, that's made up on the spot. And of course, we don't have any recordings of what he might have been playing from back in the day. So in those places, I was able to write music that really helped us understand what a performer and what a rock star he was. And so some of the music that he plays when he's really just showing off is a kind of, it's a little more rock influence than was probably played in France in the 1700s, because he really, we got to get the sense that he may be holding a violin and he may have a powdered wig, but he is completely owning the stage the way any guitarist would today. And then also there's a place where he's really introspective and he's backstage and he's just playing his soul. He's not thinking no one's watching him. And that music's very melodic and expressive. And so I had a chance to write some music to help complete his character as well. But then what holds all of this together is that there's a theme that was taken from his music, from his first concertante quartet, actually. And this theme was from enslaved people. And it's a theme that he chose to put in his music as a way to include the part of himself that really couldn't be shown to proper French society. And that theme, we hear him as a child play it at the beginning of the film. We hear his mother hum it to him when his mother arrives on the scene. And finally, in the piece he writes at the very end, he uses that theme to help, finally, when he chooses to turn against the crown, that theme becomes indicative of him finally being willing to show the parts of himself that he felt he couldn't show in society. And the film, the way it's written, really helps us understand how and why he might both feel pressured to try to fit in and yet also come to realize that it was time to stand up and be counted.
How did this project in particular stretch you artistically and personally?
You could tell I feel an obligation to, you know, do right by Joseph Bologna. So that makes anyone want to feel that they want to do their very best work, you know? So there's that. I really feel like this film will make people want to find out more about him. And also it's going to be a lot of young people who are learning an instrument and are of color and don't feel like they're represented in this music. I think this film will help them understand that, no, you are represented. And not only are you represented, but you're welcome and you belong. And that to me is unbelievably important. So I felt that during the entire time I was working on the film. And whenever you feel like the work you're doing matters, you just feel both like it's that you have to level up, but that also you're really lucky to be involved. Also, what I got out of this was I got to take a deeper dive than I ever had into Bologna's music, to the point that I can now identify certain things about it that I think are kind of his signature, if you will, you know, and I didn't know what that would have been before. And now I do. So I feel like I have a much closer relationship to his music than I ever did. And that's a great thing.
There's a moment, as you had talked about a little while ago, where Joseph reclaims his Black identity and his fight for justice. I was wondering, how do you musically compose and score reclamation of Black identity?
Yeah, that's a great question. For me, part of it was that the piece at the end that he plays is really a song of protest. It's a song of protest against the monarchy and the society in general, which at that time was about to fall in revolution. And you see that in the film. You see the revolution brewing. And Joseph goes from being a member of court and striving to be an even more accepted member of the court to realizing that his journey has to go in another direction. The piece at the end is a song of protest, of political protest, and hip hop is a movement of protest.
Yeah, that's right.
Absolutely.
And so it was clear to me that the music that, while we were clearly going to use the instruments of the 18th century, it had to sound like hip hop. Mm-hmm. If some producer out there heard it and thought, I got to sample this, this is going to be a great beat. That was actually the goal of the directors, Stephen Williams and I, was like, someone to hear this, you got to hear that this is something that someone would want to sample. And so therefore I wrote music, it's orchestral music, but it's Joseph Bologna's theme, but the way I treated it, to me, says hip hop.
What do you think about the challenge of having a classical music film for today's audiences? Because this is also a business. So when you're creating this artistically and you're involved in this artistically, there's a money aspect to these films. The fact that it got greenlit, the fact that it's there, the fact that we're talking about it, that's the triumph.
Exactly.
But in your head, are you thinking, how is this film going to get to everybody? And how do you deal with that challenge as a film composer, as a classical musician, and as a lover of the genre?
I was really excited to see that there was this script and it was going to be made. What that told me was that somebody, namely Stephanie Robinson, had already had those conversations in those studio executive suites where she was making the case that this is a film that speaks to all audiences, and not only is it an important subject, but it's relevant to today, and we need to make this film. And you can see that in the film. It's amazing how many of its themes are completely relevant to the 21st century. And that's, I think, fortunately, because of the way she wrote the script, other people were able to see that, because I would always have been down for a film about Joseph Bologna. But when I read her script, I was even more excited because she got why the film needed to be made today. And she was able to show other people through the script why it's a relevant story. So that part of the work had been done for me, you know, by Stephanie and Stephen. And it was just my job to make good on their promises, to show that, yes, watching the life and challenges and loves and experiences of this guy in the 18th century was going to play to modern audiences because the themes were so relevant. And the music, the way we approach the music helps connect those dots for people. And that was part of what my job was. So that's how come I got to write riffs on the violin for him, and why I got to write music that is hip hop inspired when, you know, the story called for it.
Yeah, this is a crossover of centuries, of a fusion of centuries of styles and eras.
But also a crossover of sensibilities.
Precisely.
Yes.
Even racial sensibilities.
Yes, which is just like how we live.
Right.
When you're a minority in a majority culture, mm-hmm. you're code switching. And Joseph, you see him code switching throughout the film and discovering his own identity through how he has to navigate through the world.
You're the co-founder of something called the Composers Diversity Collective, and it's an advocacy group. And what's the goal behind this, and why are you involved? Why did you co-found this?
So the Composers Diversity Collective was founded about 5 years ago. For me, Get Out had just come out, and I told you before about how back in the day I couldn't get hired.
Right.
Until I was seen by Jordan Peele, who happens to be mixed race like me. And he believed that I could score a film, and I was lucky enough to score Get Out. And so after Get Out became as successful as it was, I started meeting everybody. And I would see other composers of color, and, you know, we would say, like you do with anyone, you say, we should hang out. And finally, we realized, you know, we got to just pick a date and pick a place and say we're hanging out. Like, that's the only way it's going to happen. It's like,
hey, none of this, let's get a
It's like, exactly. No, not we should hang out. You know, this is the time and this is the place. Are you coming?
Right.
And yes. so we did that. And then we did it with only 2 weeks' notice, which is not how you plan a party, by the way. But I find there's like, you know, like, got to do it. Just make it. So I thought, you know, if we get 10 people, that'll be success. You know, we get 10 people. Well, we got 50 people in 2 weeks. And it just showed that there was a real need. And since then, so our goal is to increase visibility of composers of color throughout the media industry. And we have a website, composersdiversitycollective.org, where you can find composers from every ethnicity and walk of life and continent who write every style of music, both the ones you would expect and the ones you wouldn't expect. And I feel like in Hollywood now that people, in the last few years, we've busted the myths that diversity and inclusion is not good for the box office, or that or that Black films don't track to other countries, or all these things that were accepted as common knowledge. We've proven that that's all not true. In fact, inclusion can be big box office if you embrace it and know what you're doing. And there's a huge opportunity now, more than there was when I was coming up, for composers from every corner of the world to find directors and showrunners and people that they feel some connection with and tell stories that haven't gotten told before. So the Composers Diversity Collective is there to, if Hollywood wants to be more inclusive but feels like they don't know who to call, we want to help them solve that, fill up their contact lists with lots of diverse and inclusive people they can meet and get to know and potentially hire. And what we've also become is a really great network among ourselves. I mean, I know more composers than I ever thought that I would, and from every corner of the world. Yeah, and we're like really, we're friends.
That's so
great.
And
we hang out, and it's really been a huge benefit to all of us. Creep on in, on in, on in.
We just spoke to Grammy CEO Harvey Mason Jr. about this and how much the Grammy Institution is fighting for these rights, for royalties, residuals, et cetera, et cetera. Is the future of classical music diverse, multicultural? Do you think that classical music will have to be reimagined for a whole new generation?
I think that the presenters of classical and concert music are finally working very hard to make sure that the future is very diverse. I am in a place where I can see that happening a lot. And it's very exciting to me. And I think that it will welcome a lot more people into a concert hall space and into an opera space where they never felt like they were interested or had a place. And it's beautiful and way overdue. The dynamics of what music people are interested in is always shifting. And I don't know, I wish I knew what that was going to be in the future, but every arts institution has to accommodate and live into the world that we're becoming, not just dwell in the world that has been passed. So I would say that about concert music. As for AI, currently while we're recording this, the Writers Guild of America strike is on. And some of what they're asking for has to do with protections from AI. And the composers' concerns are very similar to that of the Writers Guild. They're the first group to take up this challenge. And it's challenging composers, not only in film, it challenges anyone who writes music. And we've already seen examples of that. And so technology has always changed the music business. And any technology that's come along has really shifted the way that artists make music and how they get paid and how they interact with their fans. And some of that has been for good and some of it has not, because things shift and people have to be, you know, kind of willing to embrace a technology rather than the people who embrace it usually end up doing better than the people who are struggling against it. But that being said, AI is a particular threat that is much more of a threat than the phonograph record was back in the day or multi-track recording. So creatives are concerned and everyone needs to be really aware of this and understand what our place in it is going to be in the future.
My last question is, considering, you know, what you've done and the things that you're doing, what do you say now to young composers who are coming up who want to do what you do, who are inspired, who realize, wow, maybe I could do what he's doing?
I would say the most important thing I would say is don't give up. What you're wanting to do is a very long game. It's a marathon. You need to adopt the perspective of a marathoner, meaning that I'm planning to be in it for a long time before I get results. And I'm not saying that you wouldn't get them quickly, because if you do, you know, God bless you. But that's not how the game is played. The game is played in the long game. And also, understand who you are as an artist. It's not enough to say, I want to be an artist. Mm. What is it that you have to say as an artist? It's okay if you don't know, because you're allowed to discover that in your art. But you do need to find out. And because that's your brand. What you do, what you have to say is your brand, and you need to know what you're good at and what you're not. And these are all things that a young artist works out and is in pursuit of. And it's really, you have to regard it as a spiritual practice. And by that, I don't mean that you need to believe or worship in any particular way. What I mean is that the creative spirit, it helps to not think of it as coming from within you, but from above you. And that what our goal is as artists is to channel that creative energy into the world. And because in believing that it doesn't come from you, it helps you remove your ego from the process. And in removing your ego is when you are most present to what it is that you have to give as an artist.
You know, before we leave, we got to ask you, what does it feel like to win a Pulitzer Prize?
Pulitzer.
I mean, you must still be digesting all of this.
What are your friends? Well, do they still call you? Do they call you Mr. Abels now?
Maestro, what's life like after winning a Pulitzer?
It's fucking great.
There it is. That's the drop the mic answer right there. Love it.
That was good. Oh, man. Congratulations. Oh, man.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks, guys. Definitely. Thank you. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Brown and Black. We'd like to thank the Pulitzer Prize winner, Michael Abels, for being on our show. And if you would like to support this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. Your help will allow us to be heard by many more people. You can follow our comments and opinions on @BrownBlackPodcast on Twitter, Instagram, and now we're on YouTube. We'll see you on the next episode of Brown and Black.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.